thorough letter from the person who harmed you to yourself, the impact on me was profound. I feel free in a way I have never felt in my life. And I think this process, we just did this process at City of Joy in the Congo with the survivors who wrote letters from their perpetrators, and the outcome was astounding.
Eve Ensler, we're going to do part two and post online at democracynow.org. Eve Ensler, award-winning playwright, author of The Vagina Monologues. Her new book is called The Apology. A very happy birthday to Erin Dooley. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll host The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Bail Trap features short films and speakers on bail fees in the United States. Money bail is one of the main causes of mass incarceration in the United States. Low-income Americans are sitting in jail for days, months, and even years simply because they cannot afford to pay high bail amounts. Films include Breaking Down, Deal with the Devil, How Much is Your Freedom Worth, and more. Again, that's The Bail Trap on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Wednesday, May 15th, 2019, marks the 71st anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their homes and became what is now one of the largest and longest-lasting refugee populations on Earth. KBOO will be participating in an all-day broadcast, along with CKUT in Montreal, WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and dozens of other radio stations in Palestine, Europe, South America, Canada, and the U.S. From 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Wednesday, tune in for Radio Free Palestine. More information can be found on the KBOO website at kboo.fm/Radio Free Palestine.
Good evening. This is KBOO Portland. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, daily soup specials, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. It's 5:02, time for your evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Democrats have made a deal with Republicans for education funding at the expense of two other important bills.
New fines created specifically for people opposing the petrochemical industry could affect protesters.
And in global news, plastic pollution continues to take its toll on the environment.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 14th, 2019. I'm Leslie McLam.
And I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Although Democrats have a supermajority in both the Oregon Senate and House, it appears that a four-day boycott by Senate Republicans was enough to prevent them from passing all of their potential bills. Democratic legislative leaders have reportedly agreed to trade two major bills for one that could provide an estimated $2 billion in state business taxes to Oregon's public schools. Last week, Senate Republicans stormed out of the Capitol after Democrats chose to create a new business tax instead of reevaluating the state's bloated pension system. Their absence in the chamber denied Democrats the quorum necessary to vote on the proposed tax. Democratic Senate leaders then agreed to scrap two of the more contentious bills, House Bill 3063, which would have prevented parents from using philosophical exemptions to avoid vaccinating their children, and Senate Bill 978, which would have increased the legal age to purchase a gun to 21, allowed universities to ban firearms on campus, and tightened other safety rules. Democratic Senator Mitch Greenlick, who sponsored the gun control reform measure, said that the deal, quote, trades human lives for politics. The deal apparently came from Governor Kate Brown, who is expected to sign it in the next few days.
The Portland State University Board of Trustees voted on Monday to raise annual student tuition and fees from $9,105 to $10,050, an 11% hike. The board voted 6-3, arguing that the increase was necessary in order to balance the university's 2019 to 2020 budget, which currently has an $18.6 million deficit. However, the tuition hike could be reduced if lawmakers provide more funding for higher education during this legislative session. All Oregon Public University tuition increases above 5% need approval from the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, which will meet on June 13th. Members of PSU's student union attended Monday's board meeting to protest the increase and plan to do the same at commission meetings in June. This vote comes just days after former PSU President Ramat Sarishi announced his resignation after reaching a settlement agreement with the Board of Trustees when allegations surfaced of his mistreatment of staff and lavish financial demands.
The principal of Wilson High School has resigned just weeks before the start of summer break. According to a note sent to parents by Assistant Superintendent Joe LaFontaine, Principal Maud Lamont, quote, will no longer be at Wilson High School, but officials are finalizing details for the transition in leadership. The principal of Roosevelt High School, Philip Ristick, has already been asked to take over the role for the 2019 to 2020 school year. Lamont's departure is the second major leadership shakeup at the school in less than a year. Just days before the beginning of this school year, then-principal Brian Chatard abruptly resigned with little explanation. Lamont was vice principal under Chatard before being bumped up to principal after his departure.
In Washington County over the weekend, sheriffs say a Mercedes convertible hit a bicyclist who had pulled off the road to check his map. The motorist then flipped the cyclist off and fled the scene. The crash occurred around 2 p.m. Saturday near the intersection of Northwest Hillsdale Road and Clapshaw Hill Road, northwest of Forest Grove. The bicyclist, who was injured, said the car's side mirror knocked him to the ground and he was bleeding from his leg. The driver is described as a white man in his 60s with a thick black mustache. He was wearing a baseball cap and driving a champagne-colored Mercedes convertible. The suspect was also reportedly driving recklessly on Old Clapshaw Hill Road, where a motorist told deputies he was nearly forced off the road by the same driver.
Florida Governor Rick DeSantis today announced that FBI officials have determined that Russian entities successfully penetrated the 2016 elections in two Florida counties. DeSantis said that the hacking attempt did not alter or manipulate any information or votes, but declined to name the two counties involved, citing a nondisclosure agreement with the FBI over the investigation. The Tampa Bay Times stated, quote, DeSantis's comments came during a surreal Capitol news conference during which he wouldn't elaborate on the highly unusual situation of the federal government asking a governor to sign a nondisclosure agreement, especially in a case involving that governor's own state. Barbara Peterson, president of the First Amendment Foundation, an open government group, said of the nondisclosure, quote, the promise of confidentiality is an empty promise in Florida, adding that if any records of the investigation were shown to Governor DeSantis, then they would be considered public unless there was a special exemption on the state or federal level.
The president's son, Donald Trump Jr., will be testifying for a second time before the Senate Intelligence Committee to talk about his father's dealings. Trump Jr. is the focus of several investigations looking into his Trump Tower meeting in June 2016 with a Russian attorney who allegedly offered incriminating emails from the Hillary Clinton campaign for president. The move comes as the House Intelligence Committee is threatening to subpoena four Trump family lawyers to determine who directed Michael Cohen to lie to Congress. The lawyers represent Ivanka Trump, her husband Jared Kushner, and the Trump Organization. The House Judiciary Committee last week moved to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of court if he refuses to testify before the panel next week.
According to a new Washington Post report, in the weeks before they were ousted last month, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen, and top immigration enforcement official Ronald Vitiello challenged a secret White House plan to arrest thousands of migrants in a coordinated operation across 10 major U.S. cities. According to seven current and former Department of Homeland Security officials, the administration wanted to target families that had crossed the U.S.-Mexico border after Trump's failed zero-tolerance policy from early 2018. The purpose was to send the message that the U.S. was going to get tough by detaining and deporting recent immigrants, including families and children. The operation also planned an effort to fast-track immigration court cases, allowing the government to deport those who did not show up for their hearings. However, Nielsen and Vitiello had concerns about the lack of preparation by ICE agents, the risk of public outrage, and worried that the operation would divert resources from the border. On the other side, senior advisor Stephen Miller and ICE deputy director Matthew Albence were apparently especially supportive of the plan. The arrests were to take place in 10 major cities that are often destinations for migrants, such as New York, Chicago, and Los Angeles. The plan was viewed as a first step towards arresting as many as 10,000 recent immigrants. Homeland Security officials said the objections raised by Nielsen and Vitiello were mostly operational and logistical, and not as a result of ethical concerns about arresting families. One official who spoke on the condition of anonymity said, quote, "There was concern that it was being hastily put together, would be ineffective, and might actually backfire by misdirecting resources away from critical border emergency response operations." Administration officials said Nielsen and Vitiello's pushback was a factor in Trump's decision to oust both officials. In April, U.S. authorities detained more than 100,000 migrants, with families and children accounting for nearly 60%, the highest share ever recorded.
A California jury has awarded more than $2 billion to a couple who claim that the glyphosate-containing weed killer Roundup caused their cancer. The verdict is the largest to date in the U.S. against the company's use of the chemical. The jury awarded a total of $2 billion in punitive damages and $55 million in compensatory damages. However, the monetary award is likely to be reduced due to Supreme Court rulings that limit the ratio of punitive to compensatory damages to 9-1. This was the third consecutive jury verdict against the company, all of which have come from California. Bayer AG acquired the company in litigation last year as part of a $63 billion purchase of Monsanto. The jury in this most recent case said that the company was liable for the plaintiffs, Alva and Alberta Pelliod, contracting non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The jury found that Roundup has been defectively designed and the company acted negligently by failing to warn users of the product's cancer risk. In a statement on Monday, Bayer said that they were disappointed with the verdict and are planning to appeal. Bayer continues to maintain that decades of studies have shown glyphosate and Roundup to be safe for human use. Plaintiffs in the litigation allege that Monsanto knew about the herbicide's cancer risk for decades, but failed to warn consumers and instead attempted to influence scientists and regulators in favor of their products. The recent lawsuits are largely based on a 2015 evaluation by the World Health Organization that classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic to humans. However, a 2017 Reuters investigation found that the agency had dismissed and edited out findings that were at odds with its final conclusion that the chemical probably causes cancer. In addition, the EPA and European Chemicals Agency have found that glyphosate is not likely carcinogenic to humans. The next related jury trial is scheduled for August in Missouri State Court.
A bill in Congress that would add protections to the Rogue and Molalla Rivers in Oregon is receiving a hearing today. A hearing is scheduled in Congress today on a bill that would expand public lands protections in Oregon. Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley have introduced the Oregon Recreation Enhancement Act, which would extend safeguards for the Rogue River and create protections for parts of the Molalla River in Clackamas County and rivers in southwestern Oregon. Pam Marsh, a state representative from Ashland, near the Rogue River, calls the bill a generational investment that is especially important because of the greater demand to visit these places.
You can be on the Rogue and you can really be out in the middle of nowhere on this tremendous river with these wonderful rapids and feel like you're the only person on the planet. That's a pretty extraordinary opportunity, and that's why people go back and back and back to the Rogue.
The hearing today is being held in the Senate Committee on Energy and Natural Resources Subcommittee on Public Lands, Forests, and Mining. The measure would create a 30,000-acre recreation area near the Mallala River, establish the 98,000-acre Rogue Canyon Recreation Area, and expand the existing Wild Rogue Wilderness Area by about 60,000 acres. It would also ban mining in 100,000 acres of the Calmeopsis Wilderness Area. Zach Collier owns Northwest Rafting Company and calls the bill making amends for unfinished business. Protections for these areas were left out of a larger public lands package passed earlier this year, but Wyden and Merkley vowed to bring them back. Collier notes these places are integral for local communities in Oregon that rely on recreation, and also the state's bigger recreational picture.
We have Keene, who's selling shoes, and we have Columbia Sportswear that's selling jackets. So the recreation goes beyond just the direct recreational impact. It goes through our larger recreation economy here in Oregon, which includes the equipment side.
According to the Outdoor Industry Association, outdoor recreation in Oregon generates more than $16 billion in consumer spending and more than 170,000 jobs. Protections from mining in the Calmeopsis are especially important to Collier. He says it's a mecca for botanists and a landscape unlike anywhere else on the planet.
I'm somebody who's paddled all over the world. To me, these creeks are the most unique and rare things I've ever seen. They're just really special. So I'm really excited that they're up to be protected. They're very deserving of protection.
This is KBOO reporter Yasmin Kobanoglu in collaboration with Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
The Vanport flood is often described as Portland's Katrina. On May 30, 1948, a Columbia River levee broke during a flood and wiped away the city of Vanport, killing 15 people and leaving thousands without shelter. The flood disproportionately impacted working-class families and people of color. The Vanport Mosaic Festival honors local history with a special focus on communities of color. Organizers describe themselves as memory activists. And here to talk about the festival is Laura Fortunello. Did I get that right?
Laura Loforti.
Laura Lofortes, thank you. Thank you for coming in. And would you please tell us more about the Vanport flood and how it's still impacting communities today in Portland?
Sure. Thank you for having me, first of all. Well, before I tell you about the flood, I want to tell you about the Vanport community, because often we talk about tragedies before we talk about the people who are impacted by the tragedy. So one of our main goals is to remember that the flood happened to people. And so I want to tell you about this incredible community that was formed between 1942 and 1948. It was a temporary city. Vanport was built to address a housing crisis. Mm. We had many, many people coming from all over the country to work in the shipyard in this area, and there was no home for them for many reasons, but also because they were not really welcome. And so Vanport was built to house the shipyard workers and their families. Everybody was here. This was a microcosm of the United States. So it was a very multicultural, very multi-ethnic, multi-generational community. And that is the community that was impacted by the flood. In 1948, in a matter of hours, the flood destroyed these temporary homes, and almost 20,000 people remain houseless in a matter of hours. It was, again, a community of people trying to build a better life for themselves and their families. And that is what we want to remember. People are still here. Many survivors, many former residents are still here. And they're part of our festival. And we want to honor their experience.
Speaking of those memories, what makes you a memory activist? What defines that?
So a memory activist is, first of all, those who tell the stories, right? So we consider those who keep their memories alive and share them with their families the memory keepers, the memory activists that inspires all of us. We feel that we are experiencing an incredible wave of collective amnesia. We don't remember, or we choose not to remember, our history. And it is the reason why we are experiencing what we're experiencing in this climate of hatred and bigotry and violence. So for us to combat this amnesia and erasure, as we intentionally forget, we need to intentionally remember. So a memory activist is someone who tells the story. A memory activist is someone who listens to the story, a teacher who shares the story, an artist who interprets these histories and make them accessible and memorable. Historians, you all here listening to about the festival. So it is, we consider this a movement that's very necessary, and it is about remembering the stories and correcting the biased records, the inaccuracy, the who got to tell the story before, and that is why we remember it in a way that it's actually not respectful and accurate for those who live these histories.
So you talk about that last year was actually the 70th anniversary of the flood, and we actually learned that until last year, no one had ever compiled a complete list of the casualties of the flood. So can you talk kind of about who died in the flood and how they're now being commemorated?
Yeah. So again, this is all the projects, all the efforts around this Vampire Mosaic is a collective effort. So many people are connected to this platform and they're inspired to seek a piece of this mosaic. So last year, one of what I called a history detective, James Burke, spent hours in the archives and seeking information in the cemeteries about the people who died in the flood. The official record says 17 people died. People who experienced the flood remember more. We will never know, but the official record doesn't mean it's the correct record. So James really dived into this this research and found 13 names of the 17 that are official, and they were just people like you and me. They were. There was a baby. The youngest one was 11 month old, and the oldest was 76. And they were working class and people who were there to build a life for themselves, and they lost their lives.
So how did the festival get started? What spurred you to get this really going?
So, of course, that's not just my own idea. I have many, but this is too big for my little brain. So this was really something that organically happened in 2014. My personal connection to the Vampire story is that I became interested in understanding the racial history of this area. I'm obviously not from here. I lived in many places, and I was puzzled, to use a diplomatic term, about the fabric of the city and how this the discrepancy between how progressive it is allegedly and the fact that it's so homogeneous and so white. And so I became interested in that aspect, and the Vampire story came about. I became pretty obsessed with understanding more, and so my personal connection to the story was starting an oral history project that's still going on. We have about 50 oral histories recorded. And through this effort, I met many memory activists at that point. We were not calling ourselves such, but we connected through, there were people who were doing tours for many, many years, theater, poetry, other oral histories, the families who've been keeping the histories alive, these memories alive. So it became a collective, and we decided to amplify this history together and to make it a celebration. So the Vampire Mosaic Festival is an exploration of difficult oral local histories, but it is a celebration of the resiliences of this community and the lessons of hope and strength that we can receive by gathering around these stories. So there is the Vampire story, that's always our entry point to the many local histories. But this year specifically, we wanted to expand the narrative and do an exploration about our local history of othering, how we, from Vampire, from way before Vampire, because of course we can't forget the native community, the othering of other, seeing others
they're just not like us.
Not like us, but in a negative term, in a negative sense, because I can see you different and appreciate your culture and your way of living. And so it's seeing you as an alien from me and less than me and dangerous. And so it becomes this narrative of us versus them. Right. And so this is a big exploration from May 21st to June 5th of the many silenced histories of othering. All the locations and all the events are in North and Northeast Portland intentionally, because it's still the vampire story and many of these histories are around.
What are some of the local partnerships that you've made to put this on this year?
Oh gosh, so many. Again, it's I think we are about 20 events, so each event is a collaboration with other communities. We go from the Oregon Jewish Museum, we go to even individuals like Ken Ford, the founder of the Black Panther. He leads a tour as part of the festival. It's an incredible collective of efforts. The Jefferson High School, they are doing a preservation legacy project. And so they're going to be presenting their audio recording at the North Portland Library. So every event is a collaboration with individuals and communities and organizations, of course.
And can you talk a little bit about the obstacles that you've faced in putting this event together for all these years?
Well, I'll tell you, an obvious answer would be to say the lack of funding. But that's too obvious. That's true. But I have to say that we have great supporters. But I do find that it's me and there is a co-director, Damaris Webb. So this is our vision together with many, many, many other people. But what we experience every year and more this year, we experience the difficulties in finding venues. Because when we think of venues, for us, it's also thinking of the accessible venues, and accessible not just in terms of ADA and physical obstacles, but really what are the invisible walls that prevent the communities we are honoring to participate.
Like transportation, parking, family accessibility, things like that?
Definitely, but even the more invisible obstacles. What is the history of that building that we think is so great, right? We don't have, that's the invisible story of place. And so there are places that might not mean anything to us, and we might think, well, this is just a place, and it has an incredible community history that would make that the perfect venue for a commemoration and a celebration of that history. So more and more we find it in North and Northeast Portland, these meaningful places are disappearing because that's the story.
Gentrification.
Exactly. So that is definitely one of the main obstacles.
And so other than the Mosaic Festival, can you talk a little bit about the other activities and events that you put on throughout the year?
Yeah, again, the Vampire Mosaic is a platform for memory activism. And our goal is to amplify, honor, preserve, and present the many silenced histories of our region. And we do that because we think that by knowing history, we can learn and then envision a future where we all belong. So that's the goal. And so as a platform, with this goal, we do exhibits, tours, oral history screenings, presentations, community engagement, dialogues, story circles. It is a truly multidisciplinary effort, and some of events that the theater, we have incredible theater programming also, because the co-director, Damaris Webb, is an incredible director and theater maker. And so it's an ongoing effort, and we produce our own event, but we also collaborate with many other organizations that make this movement so rich.
So tell us how we can participate with the festival other than showing up and enjoying the wonderful events.
Yeah, so first of all, you can go and see the program at vampiremosaic.org. And I'd say, you know, people are asking, because this time, really, the festival is 2 weeks, and it's very hard to choose when to go, what to do. And I would say, look at a program, see a story that you don't know, and just come. almost everything is by donation. Even if you don't want to donate, please come. And just be vulnerable and uncomfortable, because this is a time where we need to relearn to question what we know and what we don't know. So that's my invitation. If you, one event I'm particularly excited is May 27th. It's the whole day at Vanport. It's called The Spirit of Vanport Lives On. And it's a full day of activities from 10 to 4, tours, exhibits, and we have a memory activism fair, which I invite you to really explore, because it's also a celebration of all the other organizations and individuals and institutions who keep this history alive.
Well, thank you very much for being here. That was Laura Loforti, and that was with the Vanport Mosaic Festival. The festival is Memorial Day weekend, May 21st through June 5th. You can connect with them online at vanportmosaic.org. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 6 for preference. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversation. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 64 degrees. Today in history, in 1804, Lewis and Clark depart from St. Louis, Missouri to explore the Northwest. The expedition arrived at the Pacific Ocean 6 months later, settling for the winter near modern-day Astoria, before traveling back to St. Louis to report their findings. The quote of the day is from Indigenous rights activist and author John Trudell, who said, quote, "Historically speaking, we went from being Indians to pagans to savages to hostiles to militants to activists to Native Americans. It's 500 years later, and they still can't see us. We are still invisible."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture. On today's episode, a Wisconsin tribe faces millions in fines from gaming regulators, Vermont passes a law to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day, and a National Hunger Awareness Organization releases state data.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The St. Croix Chippewa Indians of Wisconsin face a more than $5 million fine by gaming regulators. As Wisconsin Public Radio's Danielle Kading reports, the proposed fine was sent to tribal leaders in a letter from the National Indian Gaming Commission over accusations of misused casino funds.
The commission cited more than 500 violations last month where gaming revenues were spent without proper justification. Several tribal council members and tribal chairman Lewis Taylor are accused of using the money to pay for bonuses and travel expenses. Commission Chairman Jonadev Chaudhuri says tribal leaders weren't acting in the interest of the tribe or Indian country.
We want to take as strong of an action as possible that targets both correction of the issues involved, but also sends the correct message that these types of matters won't be tolerated.
Chaudhuri called the tribe's actions an anomaly in an industry that is very well regulated. He declined to comment on whether the commission has made any referrals for criminal charges. Tribal representatives have been unavailable for comment.
That was Danielle Kading reporting. Vermont will celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day on the second Monday in October. The governor has signed a bill renaming Columbus Day to honor Indigenous people. Other states recently changed the holiday, including New Mexico and Maine. Many cities across the country already have made the move. Vermont's new law states it was founded and built upon land whose original inhabitants were the Abenaki people and honors them and their ancestors. It also recognizes all Indigenous people in the state. Six schools in the Hillsborough County School District in Florida are dropping their Indian mascot, while two other schools will reportedly tone down their sporting traditions. The Tampa Bay Times reports two high schools with mascots, Indians and Chiefs, will modify sporting event costumes and rituals. The district is seeking input from the middle school and elementary schools changing their mascots. Families were informed about the decision recently following meetings between school officials and a Native American Advisory Committee. A National Hunger Awareness Organization has released statistics showing individual hunger levels in each state. The numbers point out some issues in South Dakota, as Gary Ellenbolt reports.
South Dakota is home to some of the poorest counties in the United States. Some tribal lands count more than half their residents below the federal poverty level. The group Bread for the World compiles statistics on poverty and related food insecurity in the U.S. The group's executive director, Ozma Latif, says pregnant women and their babies who do not get proper nutrition in the 1,000 days between the pregnancy and the child's second birthday struggle for a lifetime.
Nearly half of all preventable child deaths are linked to malnutrition. For children who grow up malnourished, the effects are long-term, and there is irreversible damage for children who are malnourished in that 1,000-day window. So as you think about the future for a country or a state where there's high level of malnutrition amongst children, there are consequences for income, productivity, economic growth because of malnutrition.
Latif says Bread for the World is lobbying Congress to make hunger issues a priority. She says with enough effort, hunger could be eliminated in the U.S. in the next decade. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbold.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Standing Rock protest in 2016, federal officials have changed penalties against oil pipeline protesters that can put demonstrators anywhere in the United States in prison for up to 10 years and in debt $100,000 in fines. Now protesters from the Loe La Vie, also known as Water is Life camp in Louisiana, are getting prosecuted based on enhanced penalties specifically created for opponents of the petrochemical industry. Their protest started against Standing Rock pipeline owners, Energy Transfer Partners, which has completed an oil pipeline between Texas and St. James Parish in southern Louisiana. The pipeline crosses the Atchafalaya Basin, the largest swamp in the U.S. and a critical wildlife habitat. The protesters were on private land with the landowner's permission, but some were still arrested. Louisiana's Governor John Bel Edwards, a Democrat, signed a law last spring to make trespassing on critical infrastructure property a felony, including pipelines, natural gas plants, and property on a proposed pipeline route, even if the pipeline has not yet been built. Loe La Vie protester Sherry Feutlin said this week, quote, "They think that by upping the punishment, they're going to keep people from protesting. But what will happen is we're going to do things that are more worth getting the felony. Because now if we're going to jail, then damn it, we're going all in."
According to a recent study by the marine conservation charity Surfers Against Sewage, Coca-Cola bottles and cans are the most commonly found items of packaging pollution on beaches in the United Kingdom. According to their research, Coca-Cola brand products make up nearly 12% of all litter found on English beaches, meaning more than 1 in 10 pieces of plastic found were Coca-Cola branded. The results come from a series of 229 beach cleanups organized by the group in April. They found close to 50,000 pieces of waste, with about 20,000 of those showing identifiable brands. When other brands owned by Coca-Cola were taken into account, the company's share of waste rose to more than 15%. PepsiCo was the parent company to have around 10% of the branded waste found, followed by Mondelez International at 7%, McDonald's at 6%, and Nestle at 5.5%. The chief executive of Surfers Against Sewage, Hugo Tagholm, said businesses must take responsibility for the waste associated with their products, adding, quote, "This is not a littering issue. Business needs to provide radical and responsible new systems that drastically reduce their impact on our oceans, forests, and natures at large." The study's findings have been submitted to the UK government, which is considering ways to reduce littering and packaging pollution through increased regulation.
An American undersea explorer, Victor Vescovo, has just completed what is claimed to be the deepest manned sea dive ever recorded. However, he has returned to the surface with some unsettling news. there is plastic trash at the bottom of our oceans. Earlier this month, Vescovo set the record for the deepest solo dive in history, which was previously held by Titanic director James Cameron. Vescovo traveled 35,853 feet to the bottom of the Challenger Deep, the southern end of the Pacific Ocean's Mariana Trench. The Mariana Trench is deeper than Mount Everest is tall. Vescovo planned to chart the world's deepest underwater places. He observed four new species that could offer insight into the origins of life on Earth, but he also noticed a plastic bag and candy wrappers in the far depths of the ocean. This discovery emphasizes humans' far-reaching impact on the environment.
The Independent newspaper reported today that WhatsApp users could be hacked if they do not update their software as soon as possible. The WhatsApp company, which is owned by Facebook, has reportedly repaired a flaw that allows the app to be infiltrated by hackers by just leaving a missed call. Once hit by the hack attack, the phone is compromised without the user knowing. Until the update was released this week, there was nothing an affected user could do. The Independent reported that the technology used in the attack appears to have been created by an Israeli company that sells spy technology to various countries. An update is now available for all major platforms that fixes the bug, and security experts have urged users to ensure that their phones are up to date as soon as they can. To check that your phone has the updated operating system, on iOS, it should be version 2.19.51, and on Android, it would be version 2.19.134 or later.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, May 14th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu and Leslie McLam. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Liam Delta. The Interim Director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu.
And I'm Leslie McLam. Coming up on Wednesday on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Then starting at 8, it's KBOO's special presentation of Radio Free Palestine from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. Wednesday, May 15th, marks the 71st anniversary of the Palestinian Nakba, when hundreds of thousands of Palestinians lost their homes and became what is now one of the largest and longest-lasting refugee populations on Earth. KBOO will be participating in an all-day broadcast, along with CKUT in Montreal, WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington, D.C., and dozens of other radio stations in Palestine, Europe, South America, Canada, and the U.S. That's Radio Free Palestine, all day from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. here on KBOO Community Radio. KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
Michael Pollan is a best-selling author. His new book is entitled How to Change Your Mind: What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. And full disclosure, I have been a fan of Michael Pollan's writing for years, and it is an absolute honor for me to have him on the line with me right now. How are you, sir?
I'm good, Doug. How are you?
I'm doing well. Now, your new book, How to Change Your Mind. I understand the idea for it came about when you were interviewing cancer patients who had undergone psychotherapy using psychedelics. I should mention, by the way, that I'm a cancer survivor, 15 years and counting. Anyway, tell us about your book, first of all.
Sure. Well, you know, it did start with a magazine article I did for The New Yorker a couple of years ago called The Trip Treatment. And for that piece, I had heard about these trials going on at both NYU and Johns Hopkins, where they were giving psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, to cancer patients, people who were struggling with what the doctors called existential distress, the terror and anxiety that accompanies that diagnosis and the fear of death. And this struck me as the weirdest idea that you would take a psychedelic when you were in that situation. But they were finding that a single guided experience, and I'll explain in a minute what I mean by that, would really completely reset people's attitude toward death and their cancer, and in many cases remove their fear of dying to an extraordinary degree. And it was in the course of talking to a handful of these volunteers and that I just became intensely curious to understand how a molecule could change something as profound as your existential predicament.
It's a it afterward, too. There's the PTSD, frankly, because you cannot deal with that dread while you're undergoing treatment. If you survive, when you survive, that's when suddenly it hits. It's
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the survivors actually struggled, of course, even when they'd been treated successfully, there was the fear of recurrence, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. And I remember interviewing this one woman, her name was Dina Baser, and she was about 60. She had had ovarian cancer. It had been successfully treated. It was in remission. And but she was paralyzed by fear, and she could not go about her life. She heard about this trial at NYU and participated and had a guided psychedelic journey. And in the middle of that journey, like a lot of the cancer patients, she went into her body imaginatively and she saw this black mass under her rib cage. She knew it wasn't her cancer because it wasn't in the right place, but she recognized it at once. And she said, "That's my fear." And when she saw her fear, this black mass, she screamed at it. She said, "Get the F out of my life." And with that, at that moment, it vanished. And it never came back, she said. And she said she realized during that experience that while she couldn't control her cancer, it was either going to come back or not, she could control her fear. And it was the drug that allowed her to have that insight and to really believe in it. And she has, she said her life was changed by it. And again, this is one day, not a drug you take every day, but one you take, you know, once or twice. And she had, after that moment when the fear disappeared, she had this ecstatic experience. And she said that I kissed the face of God. And I was really surprised when she said that to me because she had told me she was an atheist. And I said, "But wait, aren't you an atheist?" And she said, "Yes, I'm still an atheist." And I said, "Well, you just said you kissed the face of God." And she said, "Well, we don't have any word big enough for what I felt. So I use the biggest word we have, and that's God. But I'm still an atheist."
Wow. Now, of course, you're not limiting your work on psychedelics. You're also looking at LSD, ayahuasca.
DMT, a drug called 5-MeO-DMT, which is a very powerful and strange psychedelic. Yeah, no, I looked at the whole range of them, not all of them. I didn't look at mescaline very much. But I, you know, they're similar drugs in that they all affect the same receptors in the brain, the serotonin 2A receptors. So they have similar modes of action, but interesting distinctions too. So, for example, LSD is not being used in the clinical research, because at least in the United States, for a couple of reasons. One is it's a more controversial drug than psilocybin, which many people have never heard of, and also because it takes so long. The LSD experience is about 12 hours, and the psilocybin experience is about half that. So, you know, you'd have to pay all the therapists and guides overtime if you were giving LSD to patients. It's just not practical.
I know there are various, there's a couple of pharmas that are working toward developing psilocybin as a medical therapy. What do you think down the road? How far do you think we are from having from FDA approval of having actual psilocybin available for psychotherapy?
You know, not as far as you might think or that I assumed a few years ago when I started on this work. The FDA, who obviously has to approve our drugs, just gave breakthrough therapy designation to psilocybin in the treatment of depression. That means that the FDA will help the researchers, in this case a pharmaceutical company from England called Compass Pathways, to go through the approval process and help them in the design of their trials and basically speed things along. So it could be in just a couple of years. You know, they're basically, they've got to do, we've done phase two trials of psilocybin for several things, and the last phase is phase three, where you give it to a larger group. And that's, we're getting started on those phase three trials now. So it may be, you know, within 5 years that doctors will have access to this treatment. But I hasten to add, it's not going to be a deal where you, you know, get a prescription from your doctor for psilocybin and go to CVS or Walgreens to get it filled. It really is psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy, so that the role of the therapist is as important as the role of the molecule. And you need someone to prepare you very carefully. There are usually two guides, a man and a woman, and they tell you what to expect before you even take the drugs. They give you advice if something really terrifying happens, which often does, or sometimes does, how to deal with that. They call them flight instructions. And the basic overall recommendation is that you surrender to whatever is happening. If you feel you're going crazy or dying or dissolving, go with it. Don't try to fight it. It's when you fight it that you get a bad trip. And then during the experience, which as I said lasts from 4 to 6 hours, the guides are with you the entire time, not saying much, but available to you, giving you a sense of comfort, you know, that somebody's watching over your body while your mind is traveling. And that's incredibly important. And then you come back the next day or two and meet with your guides and tell them what happened. And they help you make sense of it. They kind of interpret it. And it's called an integration session. And that, too, is very important. So it's important to understand we're not just talking about a drug therapy. This is a hybrid of drugs and psychotherapy.
I've got to ask. In terms of the medicalization model, here in Oregon, there is a ballot measure that's being an initiative petition that's being circulated to become a ballot measure, which would medicalize, in some respects, pretty much the psilocybin. Of course, that would sort of, it's a shortcut not waiting for FDA.
Yeah.
What do you think of the, have you had a chance to look at the thing? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I gather that the language is still being worked on. So there's really nothing definitive to look at. I understand the basic idea is to legalize in the state of Oregon psychedelic therapy, whether for sick people or not, and that's a, you know, that's a pretty bold move. I have to read it before I can really make a judgment. I think it's a very well-intentioned effort to take the really good work that's going on in the underground, where I worked with several therapists who were working underground, because otherwise there's no access to this unless you're part of the trials, to make that work legal and decriminalize it or legalize it. I'm not sure exactly what it specifies. In general, I think that ballot initiatives are not the best way to make law. I know we've made progress with cannabis using ballot initiatives, but cannabis is a very different drug. And, you know, it's just, this is a much bigger experience. You need some guidance. The risks are much greater psychologically. And so I worry a little bit about making these decisions right now while we're going through this FDA process. I feel very protective of the research going on, and I'd hate to see a backlash if we begin having a political battle about psilocybin before people really understand it or know what it's about. That said, you know, I gather it's a very carefully crafted initiative with training specified and will be done in consultation with state, you know, regulatory and health authorities and that kind of thing. So I gather it's a very thoughtful approach. I just don't know, you know, why we don't wait for this process that is unfolding right now at the federal level. Is this the right time? You know, the thing about politics is you not only have to decide what you want to fight for, but you have to decide when's the best time to fight for it. And my gut is this isn't quite the time. Maybe by 2020 it will be, and that's when it will be on the battle. But anyway, I'm coming to Portland on Saturday to speak, and I'm hoping to learn more about this initiative then, and with luck meet with the people behind it.
What kind of takeaways do you hope people will come away with?
Yeah, well, it's actually an onstage interview, and so I never know what we're going to talk about. But what I usually talk about is tell a little bit about how I got involved in this work, why I think it's so important, and actually promises a potential revolution in mental health care in this country. You know, we have a mental health care system that's really broken. Rates of depression, suicide, addiction are climbing. The tools of psychiatry are even by psychiatrists' own admission, really imperfect. They only deal with symptoms. Many of them are addictive. They have really bad side effects. And here comes a drug that's remarkably non-toxic, non-addictive, that you don't have to take every day for the rest of your life, that can not just address symptoms, but in many cases cure people of things like alcoholism and smoking addiction and cocaine addiction and potentially other things as well. So it's a very exciting time, and I like to talk a little bit about what the researchers are up to, tell some stories about the volunteers I've interviewed, and then I go into my own experience, because I felt I couldn't write this book without knowing from the inside what psychedelic therapy looks like. So I had a series of guided journeys on psilocybin, but also on LSD and ayahuasca and 5-MeO-DMT. And, you know, there were amazing travel stories. And so I'll share some of those also. And we always, of course, take questions from the audience. And this debate over, it's very timely to be in Portland because this, you know, you are, as often is the case, you're going to be on the forefront. There was a decriminalization initiative that was passed last week in Denver that would basically make psilocybin crimes, at least for possession and use and cultivation, the lowest priority for the police department. I would have supported that if I, you know, lived in Denver and had the vote there. But in general, I'm a little cautious about legalization because I think that people are using the model of cannabis, and the drugs could not be more different. This drug is, the stakes are much higher. It has to be treated with a lot of reverence and preparation. And I just don't think we know exactly how to how to fold this into our society in a way that will be safe and constructive.
There would obviously have to be some very specific training for the guides. I mean, this doesn't sound like, I mean, it's certainly not standard psychotherapy from my understanding.
No, and there are, you know, and that training is going on. I mean, there is a program in San Francisco. It's at an institution called the California Institute for Integral Studies that is offering now a certificate in psychedelic therapy. That's how far we've come. The MAPS organization, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, is offering trainings. And then, of course, there are underground trainings going on all the time. So, yeah, training is very important. You know, the other thing you have to do is qualify people to take the drug. In other words, it's not for everyone. People at risk of serious mental illness, things like schizophrenia or manic depression, they are disqualified from the university trials. And so it's very important that you be interviewed by someone and that a doctor has signed off, I think, before you take this drug. You know, in my case, you know, I was nearing 60 when I first took the drugs, and I went to my cardiologist to get his opinion because I had I had something called AFib, which is an irregular heartbeat, occasional irregular heartbeat. And so you know, people need to be careful. And I think we send the wrong message if we simply legalize these drugs by ballot initiative.
Well, folks, again, we've been speaking with Michael Pollan, the best-selling author. His new book, which is just hitting shelves now, is entitled How to Change Your Mind: What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. He'll be speaking on Saturday, May 18th at Keller Auditorium. Details are available at the website michaelpollan.com/appearances. Michael Pollan, I thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Doug.
This is Doug McVeigh for KBOO News.
You're listening to KBOO, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a new master's degree in nonprofit leadership for those who believe in the power of collective action for social change. More information online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School.
Montana morning.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2018-19 concert season. The season finale features singer-songwriter Dave Stamey performing songs of the American West.
That's Dave Stamey on Friday, May 17th at the Reedwood Friends Church at 2901 Southeast Steel Street in Portland. Doors at 7, concert 7:30 p.m.
Cowboy poet Tom Swearingen will open, and the Portland Folk Music Society Concert Committee will announce the 2019-20 season.
For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Sweetgrass County line, down where the Everstone flows.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Bridging Cities, Building Collaboration, a trauma-informed care training conference from Tuesday, May 14th through Thursday, May 16th at PDX First in Portland. The Trauma-Informed Care Training Conference will connect community partners, churches, and law enforcement on the West Coast to give them the knowledge.